Okay, 3, 2.
3, 2, hit it!
It's time to double down with Max and Stacy on Sputnik Radio. Now, coming up on the show, we talk to Jameson Lopp of BitGo. But first, as we all know, the reports of Mark Twain's death were greatly exaggerated until they weren't. But nothing has died more often than Bitcoin. Yes, the original cryptocurrency has suffered more deaths than a cat on its ninth life, or a poor sod trapped in a Shakespearean sonnet. The official tally stands at 140. That's 140 deaths in 8 short years of life, or 17 and a half times every year. That's more than once a month Bitcoin has died. Does death become Bitcoin? Stacy?
Yes, apparently death agrees with Bitcoin, because all the times that it has died, these 140 times over the past 8 years, the price has gone from a few pennies to a few dollars to a few dozen dollars to a few hundred dollars to a few thousand dollars all along the way. So it's always looking better and better as it climbs. And once again, you know, Bitcoin did hit just below $3,000 just a few short weeks ago. But today, the headlines in the mainstream media, CBS says, did a Bitcoin bubble just burst? Bitcoin and other so-called cryptocurrencies have plunged in value in recent weeks, prompting some observers to wonder whether there's a sign of market bubble bursting. So the all-time high had been $2,952.40 on June 11th. Now it's down towards like $2,200 as we record this. So the price, is it dead, Max?
Death as use case. You know, I've often thought about Bitcoin coming into existence at about the same time as artificial intelligence, robotics, 3D printing, all kinds of mucking about with the DNA, cryogenetically preserving folks, uploading your brain to computers, the great event horizon, the great merging of man and machine. I think the use case for Bitcoin that underreported is that you probably can take it with you in some post life experience, some so-called death experience. So think of all those billionaires like Jeff Bezos, who wants to keep staying rich even in death. He can only do that via Bitcoin.
Well, there's one way to look at it, but the other way to look at it is when you look at war, because of course war is quite deadly. There is no war more deadly than the Civil War. And this is what also uniquely coming at this particular 141st death is Civil War. The finance world is preparing for a Bitcoin Civil War. They're saying that Bitcoin may be the most popular, longest standing cryptocurrency, but that doesn't mean its path forward is without potential conflict. In fact, analysts are now predicting that the cryptocurrency is on the brink of civil war that could put Captain America and Iron Man to shame. So apparently it's an ideological rift. And one side of the divide, we have the Bitcoin miners who oversee every transaction made on the Bitcoin blockchain. On the other side are the developers that have maintained Bitcoin's bug-proof software. They're led by a group called Core. You know, it's a very complicated situation. We have to talk to Jameson Lopp about this. Jameson, it's moderates versus extremists, says Stephen Pear, CEO of BitPay. Your thoughts?
So you're definitely correct that there is some rift between developers and miners, but I think more fundamentally the ideological rift that's occurring here is a difference between the enterprise Bitcoin and its use cases and the cypherpunk Bitcoin and its use cases. And so, you know, enterprise is really more interested in high transaction volume, low transaction fees, seamless user experience, and having the ability to onboard as many users as possible, because that will then, you know, increase each enterprise's business and its valuation, and the whole, you know, crypto economy will continue to rise at a faster pace. While on the other hand, we have the cypherpunks who aren't quite as concerned about the day-to-day business cases and are much more concerned with the security and the sovereignty of the users. So you really end up with this fundamental trade-off of we're arguing about, should we go for low transaction fees and high node cost operation, you know, to run a fully validating node that gives you the ultimate security? Or should we be targeting, you know, higher, potentially higher transaction fees, but a lower cost of node operation so that it is cheaper for people to be self-sovereign in this system?
Right. So, and then on the enterprise side would be companies like BitPay that we quoted there, Stephen Pair, the CEO. And on the cypherpunk side are the core developers, correct?
Pretty much. It can get pretty tricky, though. I mean, even within my own company, you know, BitGo is an enterprise. We have conflicting views within different people at my company. So it's really hard to draw a straight line down this quote-unquote civil war. But I would also say that it's really more of a potential secession. But since this is a voluntary system, you know, anyone is free to leave, and it's not necessarily a war in the sense of that there will be some sort of attack on the network.
Okay, let's talk specifically about that, because there are various phrases and words popping up. Everybody in the world is just starting to get their head around the notion of Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, but now we have SegWit, SegWit2x, UASF. Something big is about to happen on the 21st of July. What are these terms? What's happening on the 21st?
Well, we're basically seeing a culmination of frustration of nearly a year now of not very much progress being made with deploying the segregated witness feature out onto the network. And you know, this is something that has been several years in the making and was first really made available over a year ago now. And we've really been waiting on miners to activate this feature to show that they are going to be validating these new rules and making the segregated witness transactions possible on the network. And you know, there's a number of different features that that enables. But then on the flip side of things, you've got a number of people who are vehemently opposed to it for one reason or another and want to take a much more simple, straightforward path of scaling the network just by increasing the block size.
All right. And then the fear on the cypherpunk side is that this would cut into the decentralization aspect of the network. You'd have power aggregating to these miners, correct?
Yeah, miners and enterprises. So one of the fundamental things that people end up arguing about is this, you know, what is the appropriate cost of a transaction or appropriate cost of operating a node? And that's why, like, there is no real, like, scientific answer to that. It really comes down more to ideology and philosophy of what use cases and what strengths of Bitcoin should we really be targeting.
Okay, so on the 21st, SegWit will or won't happen. Is there going to be a hard fork? Is there going to be a soft fork? What would each of those look like? What does a soft fork look like? What does a hard fork look like?
Right. So we have several different implementations that are currently out on the network. And the interesting ones, other than the like plain vanilla Bitcoin Core that has been out for over a year trying to activate SegWit, we have this user-activated soft fork, which basically says, if you run it, then on August 1st, you will reject any block from miners that is not signaling SegWit. That's kind of an extreme way of going about things. Technically, it is a soft fork, so it's still backwards compatible, but it could cause a chain split, which causes, you know, people on the network to have different forks on the blockchain and potentially disagree with each other. But then we have this other thing that's called SegWit2x, which kind of appeared around the time of consensus in New York. And it's trying to activate SegWit in a way that is compatible with the existing Bitcoin Core deployment and could potentially be compatible with the user-activated soft fork, eventually resulting in that having no effect. You know, if SegWit gets activated before August 1st, then it would really be a non-event and everything would go smoothly. This is certainly what I am hoping will happen. I'm cautiously optimistic. We seem to have nearly 90% of the miner hash rate saying that they're willing to go forward with the SegWit2x, which would essentially prevent any chain splits or chaos from happening on August 1st. But we're really not going to know for another week or so once we start seeing those blocks come in. But the contentious thing about SegWit2x is that it also bakes in this hard fork, a non-backwards compatible base block size increase that would activate 90 days later, which is pretty much guaranteed to cause a chain split on the network. So, you know, number of contentious things on the horizon. I'm just focused on the short term and hoping we can get past August 1st without any major catastrophes that would, you know, cause me to have to do a lot of emergency work to make sure that none of our customers lose any money.
Right. Well, 90%, that sounds pretty high. Where do you have to, do they have to go to 100%?
No, not really. I mean, you could argue that it could be as low as 51%, but of course, the higher it is, the safer it is, like the fewer orphan blocks and chain reorganizations that will happen. Really, essentially, the smoother the deployment of this new feature will be.
Okay, so if there's a hard fork, what happens to somebody owning Bitcoin right now? Do they suddenly have two sets of Bitcoin? Or the, like, what happens?
Yeah, and so it's not even hard fork versus soft fork, but really, if there is any sort of chain split, and a chain split can happen from either type of fork, and in fact, there are something like half a dozen different styles of forks that people have dreamt up. But yeah, so the safest thing to do if you're a Bitcoin holder is nothing. You know, don't make any transactions. Your Bitcoins, your private keys, they will remain exactly where they are right now. And if there is some sort of chain split, then that is a permanent chain split, then you're basically going to have to wait on the various wallets and other software providers to come out with instructions to say, well, this is how you safely split up your Bitcoin A and your Bitcoin B and transact them separately, because there is something called a replay attack that could cause you to accidentally send money on both chains when you didn't actually mean to. And that's really one of the more controversial things and the things that people such as myself are worried about, because it would require a lot of extra work for us to implement to make sure that our customers are able to transact safely on multiple quote-unquote Bitcoins.
Yeah, it's an interesting, you know, part or piece or time in the history. You mentioned at the beginning it's a bit of an ideological split. You know, I remember in the dot-com era, the first few years were driven by punks, more or less, and there was a tremendous sense of freedom. People were calling it digital asset, and you had the John Perry Barlow issued the digital
Declaration of Independence.
Exactly. And then you had the crash of 2001, and what came out of that crash were the behemoths, the Amazons and Googles, and you had a few players dominate corporate, you know, the enterprise came in and totally dominated, and the era, the early days were kind of dead. Is there a possibility that we're seeing the end of this cypherpunk era, and regardless of what the outcome is, we're entering now into kind of a post-cypherpunk era, into more enterprise-driven corporate era of cryptocurrencies, Jameson?
You know, from an economic standpoint, it's certainly possible, but I don't think that the cypherpunks are going to give up or are going to stop their work. I mean, the cypherpunks have, as a group, have been working, you know, since the mid-80s to further their ideas and build software that continues to give more freedom to people all around the world. So it's tricky for me because I can see both sides of it. I can definitely see a, you know, quote unquote enterprise Bitcoin that consolidates almost to the point of being a, you know, slightly decentralized PayPal type system. I can see that still having a lot of value and a lot of people using it and having an exchange rate that also goes to the moon. But personally, I'm just not as interested in that, and I'm going to be focusing my own energies on a system that has a much longer-term view, where I'm more concerned about the security at the individual level, so that, you know, the average person will continue to be able to afford to have a level of security with their financial wealth that has never before been seen.
We don't have that much time left, but I want to quickly get your comments on, you know, Bitcoin has kind of overshadowed gold's glory, and that's why gold has kind of stayed off the radar at the moment in terms of the financial space. But what about these ICOs, the initial coin offerings that are kind of dominating this whole space? Everybody's forgetting about the cryptocurrencies and the Bitcoin and Ether and all that sort of stuff, and everything is about ICOs. A lot of people call them scams. What do you think about this?
Some of them may be intentional scams. Some of them may be unintentional scams. I haven't really touched any of them because I have extreme doubts. I think there are very few of them that seem to make sense from a technical standpoint of, you know, why would you actually need a token or a blockchain for this type of thing? But, you know, I'm sure some of them will end up being quite successful, but if I was a betting man, I would say the vast majority of them will end in tears.
All right. Well, that's it for this episode of Double Down with me, Max Kaiser, and Stacey Herbert on Sputnik Radio. Thanks to our guest, Jameson Lopp of BitGo.com. Until next week, bye y'all.